is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, philosophy. And by the way, if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale can get to you with their terrific online courses. And in this feature, you're about to meet someone you've definitely heard of, but likely don't truly know.
He was born in the summer of his 27th year, coming home to a place he'd never been before. He left yesterday behind him. You might say he was born again. You might say he found the key for every door.
You've probably tasted their beer.
Coors. 105 years of only pure Rocky Mountain spring water. Make it yours. Make it Coors.
For some of you, it's more than a taste. It's a tradition. And for others of you, it's a daily tradition. After an honest day's work.
When a day's work was mining for gold under the frozen ground for 12 straight hours, happy hour had a whole new meaning.
Yet few have thought about the name and where it came from. How it was almost spelled Coors with a K.
A beer that's still known as the banquet beer.
A German name that got Americanized and changed to a C. A German name for a German man, Adolf Coors, who became an American man, an American legend. This is his story.
Rocky Mountain High, Colorado.
On February 4th, 1847, Adolf Coors was born into a family that was stable, until it wasn't. Tuberculosis took his mother from him when he was 14, and then came for father when he was 15. He was swiftly and suddenly an orphan. Perhaps providentially, there was a brewery right across the street from him, a brewery that would teach the young orphan a trade that he could use, that we would use, for the rest of his life. Once again, things were getting stable, until they weren't. The King of Prussia decided he wanted to become Emperor of United Germany, and Prussian men were forced to make a choice: fight the King's war, or leave the country. Adolf left the country, and he wasn't alone. An astounding 500,000 Germans emigrated to the United States between 1866 and 1870. With no money to his name, and almost no English in his vocabulary, the 21-year-old Adolf hopped onto a ship heading for Baltimore as an undocumented stowaway. Ashamed for not having paid his way, he took any job he could get in Baltimore to take care of the bill. Working as a laborer, in a brewery, as a fireman, a bricklayer, and a stone cutter. When he saved enough to venture westward, he did, landing at a brewery in a Chicago suburb. And when he saved even more, he ventured westward even more. His greatest luggage that he carried was his greatest vision, opening a brewery that he could call his own. Phil Anschutz's book, Out Where the West Begins, tells us why he decided to go westward, and specifically where. Coors heard talk of a booming new western city where Germans were the single largest foreign-born group, and he knew that where there were Germans, there would be brewing opportunities. Following his dream, in 1872, Coors climbed aboard the 3-year-old Transcontinental Railroad headed for Denver. To settle there, if you could call it settling. He trekked across prairies, through wilderness, and into the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, all in search of superior water to brew a superior beer. Coors would find his golden supply in Golden, Colorado, where springs near Clear Creek River bubbled up with cold, crisp water from the snow-capped Rocky Mountains. And a golden location it was. The population of the Colorado Territory was growing, and fast. Anschutz writes, he learned that Clear Creek had been the motherlode of the Colorado Gold Rush, attracting some 100,000 fortune seekers in one of the greatest mass migrations in U.S. history. Coors did not seek the heavy yellow metal in Clear Creek. He figured its water could be transformed into liquid gold. To top it off, his golden town of Golden was 15 miles away from Denver, a young city, but one with 7 breweries. In Golden, he would be it. Only 3 months after acquiring his golden property, he was out in the town, carting around and selling his very first batch of beer. All 31 barrels of it. And customers quickly began to pour into town, just to get his beer. Anschutz notes how many arrived on the Colorado Central Railroad, which built a spur line across Clear Creek to the brewery. Today, the Burlington Southern Santa Fe still operates that beer line. A mere 10 years later, he won a national brewing competition at the big event, the biggest event of the era, the World's Fair in Chicago. Once again, things were getting stable, until they weren't.
This is Lee Habib. And this is Our American Stories. And more on this remarkable American story, our This Day in History segment brought to you by Hillsdale College. More after this. With Our American Stories, and we're back with our This Day in History segment brought to us by Hillsdale College. Today we are celebrating the life of Adolph Coors, the founder of Coors Brewing Company. When we left off, Adolph had found his golden water supply for brewing his beer in Golden, Colorado. But like so much of his story, things were getting stable, well, until they weren't.
His golden water was turning into golden disaster on what was supposed to be a golden day, Memorial Day. The year was 1894, and the flash flood came rushing down Clear Creek Canyon and into the town. Townspeople fled, dead sheep, flattened trees, and ruined buildings left behind. Left behind with the one man who wouldn't leave. Adolph Coors. He was determined to destroy the flood, or it would destroy him. The book Colorado Vanguards paints the scene. Adolph Coors stood ground between the raging waters of Clear Creek and his brewery. Determined not to leave, Coors watched as the water sheared off an expensive new addition to his business. The man-made ice ponds where his workers cut ice blocks in winter went under, and the waters kept rising, inch by inch, up the slope. What happened next was described in Golden's newspaper, the Colorado Transcript. When Mr. Coors found the raging torrent encroaching on his grounds, with his accustomed energy, he purchased several lots on the opposite side of the creek and put an army of men to work tearing down the houses on them and cutting away the ground in an endeavor to turn the channel away from his premises. This desperate plan, quickly acted on, worked. Even though his losses amounted to $10,000, the brewery survived, and so did Adolf Kors. Once again, things were getting stable, until they weren't. Enter the Prohibition Movement. In 1907, the nearby Boulder, Colorado, voted to go dry. In 1908, Loveland was next. Golden knew better, and in 1909, voted to stay wet. But in 1916, they were told their vote didn't matter. Colorado passed a statewide ban on alcohol. 4 years later, the nationwide ban took effect. The Coors Brewery was forced to dump 17,391 gallons of beer into Clear Creek. Coors family lore says that from then on, Adolf Coors never tasted beer again. With his beer not surviving, how would his company? The only way it could... start all over again, and invent new companies, invent new products. Adolf and his sons founded a porcelain company, which fashioned cooking utensils and scientific items. Adolf Jr. even invented a strong chemical porcelain that no one else supplied. Their porcelain was later used by the U.S. government for insulators at the uranium enrichment plant, which provided the fuel for the Hiroshima atom bomb. The company still exists to this day, now called Coors Tech, and employs 5,900 people. A malted milk also came to be, and so would a non-alcoholic beer called Manna. Although we haven't found any explanation as to why they called the near beer Manna, it may very well have biblical origins. From the story of God providing the Israelites food called manna, so they could survive their travels in the barren desert. Americans were now in the barren desert of Prohibition, and needed something to survive it. Adolf would provide it with manna, although it reportedly disgusted him thoroughly to produce an inferior product. A more difficult decision was how to make do with more limited resources. The Coors family cut all of their own salaries, but Adolf was also forced to ask employees to take pay cuts. The employee union was having none of it, refusing to discuss it, and so they went on strike. Looking back on all that they had gone through, Adolf Jr. told his father, "Nobody should ever tell this family how to run its own business." Adolf Sr. agreed and fired the striking employees. If he didn't make such tough, difficult decisions, Coors might not have survived Prohibition. Most brewers didn't. There were 1,568 breweries at the start of Prohibition, and only 750 reopened when it was repealed on December 5, 1933. Adolf wouldn't see this day, but his company would. And it was because of his stoic approach towards life, an approach described by grandson William Kistler Coors in Anschutz's book. "My grandfather never thought backward, only forward. He didn't talk about the past, which had its tragedies. He focused on making the best beer in America." Actor Paul Newman believed Coors did, and so he must have.
"My boy says he can eat 50 eggs, he can eat 50 eggs."
Newman called it the best American beer bar none. He was so strident about Coors that he required it on ice at all of his movie sets and refused to be seen drinking anything but Coors beer. All the way up until 1981, you couldn't get Coors east of the Mississippi, making it for many a mystical treasure that had to be traveled for.
"Wait a minute. Why do you want that beer so bad?"
"Because he's thirsty, dummy.
See, I got a boy running tomorrow in the Southern Classic, and when he wins, I want to celebrate in style."
"How much style?"
"Well, I got a few friends and me, 400 cases.
And smuggled for. the very basis of the movie Smokey and the Bandit.
The problem is that Coors beer, you take that east of Texas, and that's bootlegging.
You know, I believe you're just a little bit scared.
That's great psychology. Why don't you just say something bad about my mother?
Your mama...
President Eisenhower joined in on this treasure hunt, requesting that his supply of Coors be brought to the White House on board an Air Force plane. And President Ford packed Coors in his luggage on return trips to Washington from his ski vacations in Colorado. Today it is the second largest beer company in America, the fifth largest in the world, and remains the largest single-site brewery in the world, producing more than 17 million barrels each and every year. And it all started with the man whose name adorns the beer, Adolph Coors. This day in history.
We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there.
Great job on that, guys. That's just some great storytelling about a great American life. And by the way, we're going to be covering a few more of those lives in Phil Anschutz's book, Out Where the West Begins. Harrison Gray Otis's story and Cyrus McCormick. And you'll love both of them. They're terrific. I want to close with just a short dramatic reading about this man's character, right out of Mr. Anschutz's book. Coors ran his family, as well as his brewery, with tetanic firmness. Promptly at 6:25 every evening, Adolph and Louisa arrived in the living room. Hands washed and hair combed, the six children marched in for inspection. They always had to be on time, recalled longtime housekeeper Alma Brushwiller. Mr. Coors Sr. was always looking at his pocket watch. At 6:30, he took Louisa's arm and led the way to the dinner table. The six children followed in a straight line. Alma Brushwiller recalls, just like ducklings. After dinner, the old man would go out on the porch and exercise with a pair of dumbbells. Alma Brushwiller remembers Adolph Coors Sr. as a, quote, very German, very precise man about everything. He spoke with a German accent. He was very prim, neat, every hair in place. Even for his breakfast in the dining room nook, he would be all dressed up in a coat and tie. You could set your watch by that man. His life was the brewery. Even on Sundays, he would go walk through the plant, just checking on things. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. On this day in history, a great man's life celebrated. Adolph Coors. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're about to get to Jesse's World, and the theme here is going to be dumb criminals. And by the way, if you get a chance, I watched a four-hour special on a really smart criminal, and the things didn't end well for this man, Bernie Madoff. And if you get a chance to see Madoff, just go to On Demand on ABC. Richard Dreyfuss turns in a performance of a lifetime, and it is remarkable. It'll make your heart stand still. It is just... and it's a remarkable piece of work. And with that, well, it's time for Jesse's World.
Somebody threw a 3.5-foot-long alligator at a Wendy's employee through the drive-through window in Florida. 23-year-old Joshua James of Jupiter is charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, illegally killing, possessing, or capturing an alligator, and second-degree larceny. He was arrested by U.S. Marshals. James pulled up to the drive-thru window for his order, got a drink from the employee, and then threw the gator into the restaurant, according to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. A clown in Alabama was recently arrested for DUI. A motorist told police they saw a red Ford SUV that had been driving erratically. The SUV was reportedly weaving from lane to lane. When police caught up with the SUV, they initiated a traffic stop. The driver of the vehicle was dressed as a clown. He told the officer he had a few drinks at a local restaurant and gave no indication as to why he was wearing a clown costume. It was also found that he had an outstanding felony warrant for a theft of property in the first degree. The suspect was arrested and charged with DUI as well as the outstanding warrant. His bond was set at $2,500. A man whose legal name is Bizao Doodoo Zippity Bop 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 was arrested for assaulting a college police officer and a deputy in Washington State. After he was caught tearing down flyers on the Evergreen State College campus, cops said 34-year-old Zippity Bop Bop attacked an officer trying to subdue him. Once the officer had the man on the ground, he repeatedly thrashed around and went for the cop's gun, bit him on the finger several times, and tried to stab him with the pen. The officer punched Zippity Bop Bop in the jaw and eventually used a taser on the man to subdue him, but he got up and fled. During a chase through a wooded area, Bizao Doodoo Zippity Bop 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 allegedly continued to thwart law enforcement's efforts to stop him, throwing sticks and rocks and a brick at one of the deputies. He also managed to break free of one of the deputy's electrical taser lines and continue on despite being hit by a metal baton several times. Bizao Doodoo Zippity Bop 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 was eventually tackled, handcuffed, and arrested. He was charged with two counts of first-degree assault, third-degree malicious mischief, and malicious harassment. His bail was set at $50,000. Bizao Doodoo Zippity Bop Bop Bop's given name before he changed it in 2011 was Jeffrey Drew Wilski. For Our American Stories, I'm Jesse Edwards.
That is terrific. Wait, Bow Zao Doo 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 Zippity Bop Bop Bop?
Close enough.
No, what was it? I really want to know this.
Bizao Doo Doo Bibbity Zop. I can't even remember. I have to have it in front of me.
He looked for any excuse to say his name. You just kept saying it. I kept thinking of the Disney song, too.
Yeah. Zippity Doo Dah?
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
What the heck?
It's time for... That's the water cooler sound?
I guess that's what it's supposed to be.
It's time for our water cooler segment with Jesse as well.
This week's water cooler segment, movie makers blew up a bus in London, apparently. But they forgot to tell people that they were going to blow up a bus for a movie, so naturally, everybody thought it was a terrorist attack.
That's not good.
Kids were screaming, women were wetting their pants, men were wetting their pants, too. Special effects crew for a Jackie Chan movie.
That's not. I mean, can you imagine the same thing with like Jaws? You know, you're putting one of those sharks and you don't tell anybody. Not a good idea.
I saw a really cool, it's like a drive-in theater, but instead of a drive-in theater, it's a theater on the side of a lake. And they were watching Jaws while they were in the lake floating on their little floaties.
That's nice.
At night, too. You kind of get this little effect of.
That's great.
Don't put your hand in the water. Something else, warehouse robots apparently can boost productivity by 800%. So that's, I guess, where our jobs
that's where things
be going.
Are going.
The Lotus, the Locust robot can zip around a clothing warehouse larger than 6 football fields and can work for 24 hours without a lunch break or even a salary.
Have you ever seen those robots work?
Oh, yeah.
It's really unbelievable.
Yeah, you got to Google it if you haven't seen the videos. It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's scary.
They say it's going to drive us out of jobs, but there's always going to be technicians to fix the robots.
Of course.
So get into,
and somebody to make the robots, unless robots make the robots.
Yeah, then we could.
That could get scary.
You know, the robots transport items that have been picked off the shelves by humans and then bring them to the front of the warehouse to be sealed and delivered.
Right.
Emotional support animals. We were talking about this last week.
Oh, yeah.
It's becoming a big trend and a big problem.
Pet therapy.
Yeah, pet therapy animals.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking about doing this because I'm going to go home and visit back in Oregon in a few months during the summertime. And we can't take our dog. It's a big pain in the butt. It's like $600 if you want to take your pet. And you have to have it between 70 and like 80 degrees outside.
Yep.
To even be allowed to pay them this kind of money. But you can bring them on. There are legitimate cases of people who need emotional support animals supposedly in the air. I don't buy that for a second. But experts say that far too often people are abusing the system to save a buck. I'm shocked.
I'll write you a note. Do you want me to write you a note?
You have to be like a doctor, but apparently...
I have a JD. Well, that doesn't count, huh?
It can cost up to $600 to fly a regular pet, but it's free if you have a note from your doctor. Plenty of websites, I guess, are offering emotional support animal certifications. So all you have to do is fill out a questionnaire. Yes, I need a... Well, you could just, I mean, in that case, you could just print one up. I guess you'd probably have to be accredited, though.
Yeah, I think so.
The airlines,
I mean,
is this
any size pet? I mean, is there a certain, what's the size limit? Is this allowed to go past?
We reported last week, some lady brought a live turkey on, and somebody, yeah, she brought a live turkey on from Seattle to Salt Lake City, I believe it was.
Get out of here.
Round trip. And they were having all sorts of problems. And last year, some lady brought a pig on, and the thing was defecating in the seats and screaming like a stuck pig.
Well, it's a pig.
Yeah. It's a big problem. A man died trying to complete a Krispy Kreme challenge. He had a heart attack.
Well, what was the challenge?
Organizers at the annual Krispy Kreme Challenge said in a news release that 58-year-old man dropped out of the race during the first mile Saturday morning. Because of chest pains, he was pronounced dead at a nearby hospital.
This is literally a run. Greg told me about this today, where they downed like 12 Krispy Kremes in the middle of their run.
It's crazy.
It's terrible. The unidentified runner left the race before reaching the Krispy Kreme location, in which some competitors eat a dozen donuts before completing the final 2.5 miles of the 5-mile course.
Ah. Well, if Krispy Kremes wasn't out of business, they're about to run out.
This is not good. Imagine,
you know what's
the
awesome?
Lawsuit.
When I moved out here to Mississippi, in the grocery store, you can actually get Krispy Kreme.
Yep.
That's pretty awesome.
Isn't that great?
I mean, you don't have to, and they taste pretty close to the stuff you get at the store.
Yeah, especially if you go there early in the morning.
The drive-in? Oh, man, they're good.
Thank goodness they don't make those kids and those guys run after the Coney Island hot dog eating contest. That would be ugly.
Alaska's commercial fishing industry, I guess, just had its first year with no deaths.
Really?
Yeah, the local commercial fishing industry, for the first year-long period on record, from October 1st, 2014 to the end of 2015, the Coast Guard recorded zero commercial fishing fatalities. Good for them.
That is good. That's dangerous work, man, going out into the Bering Sea and catching king crab and all those guys in deadliest catch.
You couldn't pay me enough to do that.
No, there's no amount of money.
It's a death trap, yeah.
Those guys are crazy.
And if you don't die, you're going to get a knuckle smashed. Or...
exactly. Or one of those fishing pots is going to hit you in the head.
God.
You know what I love about deadliest catch? These guys get hit in the head with a fishing pot. Nobody lawyers up. Nobody lawyers up.
Just the temperature alone out there. You'd think that your hands would freeze up. You wouldn't be able to. I mean, if it's 65 degrees in the office here, I can barely type on my keyboard because my forearms are.
Hey, Lee, didn't your hands freeze up the other day? And
yeah,
you got to go back inside?
Yeah, I was in New Hampshire the other day, and there was like a foot of snow. I didn't prepare, and I went out there
It's like the Tin Man.
I was out there like 5 minutes. I turned into a little like schoolgirl and ran back into the hotel crying. I'm not meant for nature.
Oh, at least you admit it. You're a healthy man.
I am a healthy man.
Somebody compiled a list of regional slang. I guess it's a new list. It's quite a bit because each state has one. We won't be able to get to all these, but... like, I guess we'll just have to save this for next time because we only got like 45 seconds.
Yeah, save that because I also want to get into the states where people talk the fastest.
Yeah, I mean, this will be an interesting topic to couple with that.
Yeah.
But that's all we got for water cooler.
Well, thanks for that. That's great. And folks, that's why you listen to Our American Stories, because you learn some things and sometimes you don't learn a damn thing. And in this particular one, hopefully you didn't. And hopefully you had a few laughs. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Story. Thanks, Jesse, for that. And Alex and Greg and the crew here. And more after these... well, after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And the show is airing out of Oxford, Mississippi, small town America, home of Ole Miss, to the rest of America. We thought, wow, what a novel idea that small town America would broadcast to big town America, which is filled with small town Americans, as opposed to everything coming out of New York, Washington, D.C., or Los Angeles. There are just a few other places to live, and they're fine places to live. And what we're going to be doing today on Our American Stories in this segment is, well, tell the story of big versus small. We love that framework of underdogs going up against big obstacles, big businesses against small businesses, big government against small government, and which is better. And our preference, of course, is for smaller things, and we're always rooting for smaller things to turn into bigger things. We recently bumped across such a story on a great news website called Opportunity Lives, which you can visit at opportunitylives.com. It was titled, How Big Victories Can Come from Small Beginnings, and it profiled a normal citizen in Sturgis, Mississippi, like the famous town of Sturgis, South Dakota, that hosts an annual 700K-person motorcycle rally. Sturgis, Mississippi hosts its own version, swelling its town of 210 people to 20,000 every year. The Sturgis citizen that Opportunity Lives profiled, Elaine Vichorek, actually knows a thing or two about motorcycles. She and her husband's version of retirement was starting a motorcycle repair shop, but not just any repair shop. They are one of the world's top experts on restoring and repairing antique BMW motorcycles. How do these people, and in Mississippi of all places, get into such a business? There's only three words for it, only in America. But Elaine wasn't profiled for her motorcycles. She was profiled for what she did when she found that she had had some extra time in her hands and what led her to receive the State Policy Network's Unsung Hero Award. We were so intrigued by her story that our field correspondent Alex Cortez spoke with Elaine earlier today, and we now bring you portions of their conversation.
You know, from radio, TV, everyone knows about national issues that they can't do anything about, you know, except it makes them feel bad, you know, and maybe they'll voice outrage at other people. But as far as actually doing something about those things, it's implausible. And when I started looking at county and state government, I realized that I didn't understand even how politics works. I didn't understand the legislative system. I was just ignorant. I had to start from scratch. I really did. 3 years ago, I knew nothing. I had to learn from scratch. And once you begin to learn the system, then you begin to see where you can accomplish some things, or at least try. But first, you got to learn. In order to do that, you have to have some training, or someone has to tell you. You have to find out. You know, even in my business, I always was never afraid to try to do something because I know that I can learn what I need to know. Either it's in a book or someone can tell me, or if I ask enough questions, you know, of enough people, eventually I'll find the answers that I need.
Well, Elaine then told us about one of the early targets of her activism.
Oh, I'm telling you, that's something I run into a lot, is that even when there's a good law on the books, I'm amazed at how many times bureaucrats, board of aldermen, county supervisor board, and they violate state law. And no one holds them accountable. No one ever does anything about it. And the Mississippi Department of Wildlife has a website where they have to announce the rules and regulation changes. And they announced this gun permit price increase. And thank goodness for my friend, he called me and said, hey, you know, that's illegal. They can't do that. Only the legislature can do that. I said, are you kidding? So anyway, we put a stop to their price increase really fast. Well, in the process, I started researching the price of Mississippi gun permit compared to other states. And Mississippi has the lowest income of the nation. And yet, we were paying the fifth highest price for a gun permit. And I thought, well, that's a good reason to ask for a reduction in price. So I got my representative to introduce a bill to lower the price. They did. They reduced the price by $40. The Mississippi Department of Public Safety wanted a $6 increase, but they had to settle with a $40 price decrease. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Oh, that is so cool. Be still my heart, Elaine. And by the way, she said something fascinating there. Only the legislature can raise taxes. But folks, this happens state by state. And my goodness, the things that the federal government do through their regulatory agencies, they pass tax increases all the time. And if you only knew, if you only knew. So here's one of the things she fought for that was cited for the Unsung Hero Award, ending state mandated vehicle inspections.
Well, that is a personal issue of mine. My father once owned a service station. He sold gas and he was a mechanic. And at the very, I can remember when those safety inspections began. There was a long list of things he had to do. He actually had to remove the wheels on the car to inspect the brake line, brakes and all this kind of thing, aim the headlights, a lot of things he had to do. And even at the time, back in the 1960s, he said that he wasn't sure it was worth his time, the money that he got. You know, he got like $3, and then you have to send $2 to the state of Mississippi. And even then, he said, you know, he wondered if it was worth his time. Well, through the years since then, jump forward to the year 2000, every car is required to have this safety inspection sticker, but the mechanics, they don't do the inspection. In fact, we tried to find one inspection station in the state of Mississippi that did a true, complete inspection for $5, and we could not find one.
And it's not their fault, right? I mean, it's they're forcing them to do a service that they are losing money on.
Right, exactly. And so today the inspection was more or less, are all your lights working and your windshield wipers and horn work? And they'll slap on the sticker. So it was just a farce. It's just a fake program. That, I mean, and when they leave the station, you know, 30 minutes later, what's to keep a light bulb from going out? It really wasn't helping safety. I have a good Facebook page. We have like over 22,000 people. And I kept pushing this issue over there. And yes, there would be a few people that go, oh, we need that for safety, but the majority of Mississippians understood it's a farce. And so we started raising Cain. And I hate to say this was a long term. And there was a bill already introduced every year since 2008. So it wasn't a matter of getting a bill. It was a matter of getting it passed through the legislature. It always failed. So I harped on this and we did petitions. Everybody contacted their legislators. It went on for 3 years with no success. And 1 year, the lieutenant governor announced his issues for the upcoming session. And it was so funny. The person, my friend that sent it to me, he says, well, it looks like you set the lieutenant governor's agenda this year. And I looked, and there were three of my issues on his list. And one of them was to end the vehicle inspections. And I was so happy. And when he put it on his agenda, it magically gets passed, you know. So that saves, you know, it saves Mississippians probably about $3 million a year. But the most important thing it saved is the time and the trouble and the hassle to go get this done. You know, maybe people are missing work to go get this done. It's just, you know, it's just very liberating.
Well, the power of one, folks. Elaine wasn't always successful. In fact, in her acceptance speech, she was humble enough to detail three of her biggest failures. She spoke with us about one of them.
I got together about 20 people, and we were willing to set aside our differences and concentrate on what we could change. And so we started meeting in local restaurants and, you know, talking about issues. And some leader I was, you know, a leader needs to know where you're going, right? I didn't really know where this was going. I knew that we needed work to do, but I didn't know what that could be, and I didn't know how to do it. And so our meetings were more or less nothing but gripe sessions. And over time, that group died. So there was another failure.
Finally, Elaine told us about one of the biggest criticisms she receives.
Some of my issues, they're really small, really small. What people say, oh, that's so insignificant. Why fool with that when we have all these huge problems? And I always tell them, I said, listen, we didn't lose our freedom in one big bill, in one big leap. We lost it in inches, a little bit at a time. I said, and if that's how we have to win it back, I'm willing to do that.
Wow. Again, be still my heart. Elaine Fechorek. Her story chronicled at opportunitylives.com. And my goodness, the Unsung Hero Award right here in Mississippi, where it belongs. Great work, Elaine. Great job on this, Alex. Our Mississippi Queen for the day. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and every other week, we bring you a feature called Women Who Dare. From the world-renowned author and journalist Gail Sheehy, it profiles women who dare, what they dare to do, and why they dare to do it. Gail now brings us this week's feature.
Today's daring woman started her daring in high school when she became pregnant and dared to be a single mom to her son, Austin. 3 years later, Max came along. Life was hard, but she and her family were getting by. Her name is Jen McNary, and one day she noticed something different about Austin.
Austin was struggling with things like alternating feet when coming up the stairs. He was falling and injuring himself quite often, and he also had difficulty walking long distances. He would get tired and whiny.
Austin had a disorder that leads to muscle degeneration. And there are 43 different types of muscular dystrophy. What did Austin have?
So Austin has Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which is the most common lethal genetic disorder in boys.
And what is the treatment?
So at the moment, there are no approved treatments for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Some boys respond well to steroid treatment, which sometimes can lead to a slight delay in loss of muscle. But in general, their muscles always break down, and it is 100% fatal.
Were you told there was nothing you could do?
So my first question was what type of a treatment he needed, of course, and I was told that there was nothing that could be done, and even the first few neurologists made very clear to me that this was a disease that was not treatable and I should just take my child home and love him.
Oh, that must have been devastating. You had a second child at that point, a 3-month-old, Max. Well, how did make you feel?
I had done some reading at the library shortly after Austin's diagnosis, and I realized that the disease could run in families. And so I insisted that myself and then my younger son be tested for the disease. I came back negative as a carrier. However, some carrier moms can carry the disease in their eggs, and that is the case. I carry it in some of my eggs because Max was also diagnosed at 3 months old as having Duchenne muscular dystrophy.
Where did you find any hope?
My boys were young, and they really looked like very healthy little boys. And so until they started being incredibly symptomatic later on in their childhood, I really had hope that there was going to be a treatment developed in their lifetime.
You were the mother of two dying children. And when Austin turned 9 and a half, you stopped thinking there was going to be a cure.
So I had been an adamant follower of research, and having hope depends on having a idea that something is in the works for your children. And so I actually became aware of exon skipping, which could be a viable treatment for my sons. Unfortunately, by the time that the clinical trials began, Austin was already too far progressed in his disease. He lost the ability to walk at 10 and a half. And the trial didn't start until he was 12 and a half. But his younger brother, Max, was 9 and a half, and he actually got into the trial. He was one of 12 of the original children in the United States to receive the exon skipping treatment.
And that's the point at which you decided to make it your mission to fight to get the drug to everyone who needed it. But you had to fly back and forth from one side of the country to the middle in a very funny way. Paint this picture for us, you crossing the airport with a newborn strapped to the front of you and all the rest of the baggage.
So at the time that the trial began, I did have a new baby girl, Nora, as well as a three-year-old son, James, both healthy. And I was taking Max to receive his treatments in Columbus, Ohio. And at the time, we lived in Vermont. So it was a trip, two-hour trip to the airport in Hartford, Connecticut, and then a flight to Columbus, Ohio, every single Tuesday for a year and a half. That trip became completely worth it. About 16 weeks into the trial, the trial was double-blinded, placebo-controlled, so I didn't even know if he was receiving drug or placebo. But about 16 weeks into the trial, his grip strength improved, evident by the fact that I watched him open a container of milk at the airport. That was the first time we had ever seen him open a container because these boys have very weak hands and muscles. Shortly after that, he stopped using his manual wheelchair to cross through the airport. And I thought, this drug actually works. Not only do I now know he's on drug, but I know it works. And I became incredibly eager, even without data to support it at that point, to get this drug to my older son, who literally sat home during these trips and just sat in a decline. I could see the decline from week to week. He was just getting worse, and he was not receiving drug, and his brother was getting better.
What a bittersweet situation to be in. But you said that a wonderful bonding occurred between the two boys. Your younger boy would help the older boy in the middle of the night get up and get a glass of water for him, help him put on his backpack, get ready for school, and the two of them became bonded in the most courageous and tender way. That must have helped. But still, Austin couldn't understand why the grown-ups in his world couldn't figure this out and make things happen faster for him. How does it feel to have a child that's dying and the other one is possibly having a drug that can help him, but you can't push this fast enough to know that it's going to work to save them in time?
You know, obviously, it's an incredibly, deeply painful feeling to know that there's this treatment that's just out of reach, and to know that because the two boys are sleeping in the same bedroom at night.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And when we come back, more from Gail Sheehy, Jen's story, Austin's story, after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we left off in our Women Who Dare segment following Jen and her son Austin's dilemma. And Gail Sheehy picks it up where she left off.
You know, I knew without a shadow of a doubt this drug worked, and I knew my older son needed it. And I think we turned that into determination. And it was one conversation with my son, Austin, that turned this into a fight for all boys. He said, "Mom, are you going to get me this drug?" And I said, "Of course I am. I'm going to find a way. You know, maybe I'll scale the building and steal the drug. But I will find a way to get you the drug." And you know what he said? He said, "Okay, great, but what about my friend?" And I realized...
What about my friends?
He had friends with Duchenne. And he said, well, my mom is going to get me this drug, but I have friends that potentially are worse off than I am, are more progressed than I am, and they need it more. And I still remember that day because that's when it turned from a fight to get one boy on a drug to a fight to get this drug approved so that everybody around the world has access to it.
Well, that's when you become a daring woman on behalf of all mothers with children with this illness. So by the spring of 2013, you were working as hard as you could, but you paid a heavy price for your daring. I think your marriage fell apart. Your husband told you he wanted a divorce?
So my husband was not the father of Austin and Max, although he was the father of, and still is, of James and Nora, my younger two children. I had always been a stay-at-home mom and very focused on just my family, and I think my fight took me out of the house. Remember, I had a very, very young daughter and a toddler son, and then a boy who was also non-ambulant that I had to leave at home for my husband to deal with while I was gone. And I was in D.C. a better part of every week fighting for this drug approval. And I think any marriage is tested by a terminal illness, but I think particularly when your life changes, you change. And I think that that's what happened. Although the divorce is just a bump in the road, to be perfectly honest, I have bigger things to worry about.
Well, you had to be laser focused on saving your children. Everybody would understand that. But you did a guardian angel appear? Did you have a friend who came along to help you?
So, yeah, you know, the great thing about this journey, even though it's been a really difficult journey, is it's really shown me some amazing people. One person that stands out, of course, is Christine McSherry. She's currently my boss as the founder of the JET Foundation. When she reached out to me, I was just a mom in Vermont trying to save my sons and make a difference. And she had the foundation that could offer some support and guidance in helping us to amplify our voices. And
on a personal level, just to lay this out, you didn't have a job. You couldn't get a job. Take Max to his infusion. Christine helped you with all of that. Actually, she said, you know, move to my town. Did you?
I did. Her husband and she showed up one day with a moving truck and basically said, we've found you and the kids an apartment. Take what you can fit in the truck and we're going. I had just a few hours notice. And it's been an amazing opportunity to have this job, and it's allowed me the ability to continue the fight without worrying about how I was going to take care of my children.
What wonderful grace. And you then, together, launched a campaign called Raise to Yes to press the FDA to this drug. How has your campaign gone?
Raise to Yes has been a very great vehicle to amplify the voices of Duchenne families all over the world. And we actually received hundreds of thousands of votes on a White House petition asking for the accelerated approval of eteplirsen. That hasn't exactly done anything besides call attention to Duchenne, but I think it is one of the reasons that this drug is even being considered by the FDA next week.
But time and again, you showed absolutely no compunction about traveling somewhere, collaring a CEO of the drug company and saying, this drug works, it's helping my son, what do you need to get it to market? You just don't stop. And that persistence is what has made this race to yes continue to go forward, even though the FDA has backed off and lied to you and then come back and then pull the rug out again. You just never give up. I know one of your friends used the analogy that your children are on the Titanic and we know it's going down with 100% certainty. There's a lifeboat, and engineers say it's reliable. Why don't we get into these lifeboats and see if they can save the children while we're working to get more lifeboats that are more reliable? That's the argument, right?
So, you know, we've met with the senior officials of the FDA for, you know, 4 years now, and the key arguments make no sense to me whatsoever. They don't question the safety of the drug. It has a 100% safety profile. Sometimes they question the small number of patients in the original trial. But my answer to that is, with a rare disease, you do have small patients in a trial, and you legally can approve a drug based on that. So what is the argument? I think the argument is that the FDA tends to think in old terms, double-blinded, large, long, controlled, placebo trials.
Is that necessary? Is that still necessary in the 21st century?
In a disease like Duchenne, we know the natural history. We know that these boys stop walking between 8 and 12 years old. We know they don't produce any dystrophin at all if they have Duchenne. So we know what to expect. These boys die. They decline and then they die. On this drug, they stabilize. They have a much slower decline at worst. And in some cases, like my son Max, they recover skills. And they stop collapsing and falling and hurting themselves. And they don't use wheelchairs. So it is a very, very easy comparison. If you ask anybody with a child with Duchenne what they were doing at 14 years old, like my son Max at this point, it was not going out and getting dressed on his own, getting on a bus and going to school with no wheelchair all day. Boys with Duchenne do not stabilize. Boys with Duchenne who take a eteplirsen are stable and have a great quality of life.
Has Max learned to ride a bicycle? What else can he do that is normal?
So Max had a great recovery about 2 years into the trial where he decided he might like to ride a bicycle. He also has osteoporosis, so I try to avoid the bike riding, but he can pedal a bicycle. Some of the other amazing things that he can do maybe don't sound amazing to other people, but to boys who typically can't even walk at his age, the fact that he can step up onto a curb on his own without support, the fact that he can get in and out of a vehicle by himself, he can dance, he can jump 2 feet off the ground, he can go.
Those are huge.
Yes,
those are huge accomplishments. So he can have friends and live a normal life.
Correct, exactly. And that's all we want, is something a little closer to normal for our boys, something that provides happiness and a quality of life.
Do you think that most parents who have children with what would be a fatal illness with no cure would prefer to take the risk that a medication without full 100% clinical trial approval, to take the chance that it might help or might hurt, rather than just accept the inevitable fatal end of their child's life?
I can say without a shadow of a doubt that any child who is amenable to this drug, their parent would want them on the drug. In fact, I can also say that we've spoken to a lot of prescribing physicians in the Duchenne space, and some of them will be speaking to the FDA next week in favor of approval because they would like to be able to prescribe this to those children. So this is not just desperate parents who want something. This is clinicians who want to be able to treat these children with this drug. Like you said, this is not at this point a safety concern. This drug has a safety profile, so we're not going to do any damage. So if the only risk is that it might not be as good as we thought it was, we would take that risk in a heartbeat.
Your voice speaking up again and again, over how many years has it been now?
It's been almost 5 years since the start of the trial.
You have absolutely been fearless about pushing, pursuing, researching, advocating, and now you have really a major crossroads next week, and we wish you every good luck. Thank you so much for being with us, and love to Max and Austin.
Thanks so much.
And when we come back, we'll hear from Gail. More after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we were just talking about this song, and no matter how often you hear it, it makes you think of at least two movies. And the first, of course, is Easy Rider, Jack Nicholson, Peter Fonda, and, of course, Lost in America. And it's so darn funny when you hear it with Albert Brooks and his wife checking out of society and getting on their RV and hitting the road. It is so funny. What's not so funny is the segment we're about to hit. Unless, of course, CNN is trying to be funny, but not succeeding. And we did a piece a couple of weeks ago, which we called, What is Lisa Ling Up To? And What is CNN Up To? Letting Lisa Ling be up to whatever she's up to with her show, This Is Life. Well, she's preparing for her third season of programming where the award-winning journalist goes on what CNN calls a, quote, gritty, breathtaking journey to the far corners of America. And, of course, when you hear that, you're thinking, oh, they'll go to Maine to a little fishing town and maybe way down to Baja in California, maybe even like Key West. No, it's the far corners of Lisa Ling's very strange mind. And by the way, that's okay. Let's see where she's going. Let's see where she's taking us. Last time we followed some Satanists, and it wasn't tongue-in-cheek. She took them quite seriously. And we did too. And this time, it's not the Satanists next door. Well, it's this little group of guys called the Mongols. And of course, they're a notorious outlaw motorcycle gang. But I don't think Lisa Ling knew that. And if she did, I don't think she believed it. And so, well, I think she just thinks they're a bunch of guys who get up and motor around like a lot of us older duffers do on our Harleys, just to make us feel young and feel the wind at our hair, or maybe even the wind against our heads. But as you will hear, CNN's This Is Life with Lisa Ling, the Mongols are just victims of circumstance. They are really just good guys who've been incorrectly smeared with a bad reputation from law enforcement. Federal officials, by the way, like the FBI and the Justice Department, well, they don't quite agree with Lisa Ling. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives says it considers the Mongols, who've managed to rip the prized real estate turf of Los Angeles away from the infamous Hell's Angels. Yeah, you do that being a bunch of fun-loving duffers. Well, they're now considered the most violent motorcycle club in America by our own Justice Department. But Lisa Ling wants to take a look at the bright side of life in the Mongols. They've had long-running confrontations with law enforcement concerning illegal drugs, especially methamphetamines, money laundering, robbery, extortion, firearm violations, assault, and murder, just among other things you do on a Saturday night or Sunday afternoon bike ride with buddies. Mongols themselves appear to agree with the criminal label. They wear what is known as a 1% patch on their jackets. And no, this isn't Bernie Sanders' 1%. This refers to a comment from the American Motorcyclists Association saying that 99% of motorcyclists are law-abiding citizens, implying the last 1% are outlaws. With this small bit of information, let's see how CNN and Lisa Ling managed to portray the Mongol Motorcycle Club, like it's the Rotary Club. They begin the show by covering what else? Family Fun Day with the Mongols, hosted by the Mongols themselves at their local park. Bring the kids. Ling declares that the Mongols want to set the record straight regarding their criminality, or as Ling states, quote, let's see what they are really all about. Here's Lisa Ling.
The Mongols. This East LA-based club denies allegations that they're criminals, and they want to set the record straight. One percenter clubs almost never give interviews, but for the first time ever, we've been invited to embed with the Mongols. They're considered to be one of the biggest and baddest clubs out there, but they want us to see what they're really about now. So the first thing they've invited us to is Family Fun Day.
Tail sack race, make your way to the side.
From what I can see, Family Fun Day is exactly what it sounds like. Wives, kids, potato salad, amusements, and a few hundred hardcore bikers.
You guys want some? Hey, that's a real biker right here.
David Santillan is the Mongols' national president. Nearly everyone in the club is given a nickname, and his is Lil Dave.
Really, as you can see, we're no threat. Every time we go to an event, we police our own people. We clean up after ourselves better than the normal citizen. They're just wasting their time. I mean, they should be out there chasing real criminals. You know?
Do you think that you will always just be plagued by your past?
There's always going to be that stigma hanging over our head. We're the Mongols Motorcycle Club.
You're here. You see us. What do you think about this?
I mean, this is...
It's great, right?
It's a great family barbecue.
Yeah. And this is what we do every Sunday amongst our own chapters. We know each other's kids, our families. What else could you ask for? The police and everyone else with the stuff they're dishing out for us, that doesn't discourage anyone from anything.
How about that?
These guys sound like nice guys.
They are.
Why are we even talking about this?
We got to cover their barbecue too. Lil Dave. I can't wait to meet Lil Dave. Maybe he can babysit for my family. Lil Dave.
Lil Dave the week.
Give me a break. No threat. No need for police. Just a great family barbecue. Every Sunday. Every church does. For further context, Seedling's episode on The Satanist Next Door, by the way, where she portrays Satanists as heroic while tarring Christians as villains. Anyway, that's how the episode begins. Nice and light. A Sunday picnic. I'm sure Ling will move on to more pressing issues like drug trafficking and murder. Let's see what happens as Ling travels with the Mongols to their national gathering in Palm Springs, California. Let's go.
I've experienced a lot of things in my life, but I've never done anything like this. I'm at the head of a pack of hundreds of bikers who've taken over a California freeway. The president of the Mongols, Lil Dave, and his wife Annie are at my side. I can't stop looking behind me to see this endless formation of bikes. Every Mongol I've talked to has said there's no feeling like this. And I get it now. I get the rush of being part of this massive group owning the open road. This is what it's all about. This is what these guys live for.
Oh, I get it now. Picnics and the open road.
In Palm Springs, one of the wealthiest communities. This is all a show.
Hey, look, it's good that Lisa gets it now. I mean, she spent about an hour and a half with these folks, and she gets it. But folks, there's more. And I guess we're supposed to, too, by the way. Mongols equals fun and family and, well, living for, well, some big family trips in the bike. That's it, of course. Lisa continues her report on her ride with the Mongols. Yes, there's more.
Every once in a while, they pull someone over. It seems to be totally random. They check the guy's license and send him on his way. The police presence is definitely invasive, but in some ways, it's part of the thrill. We stop for gas and I have a chance to catch my breath.
Oh my God, my heart is in my stomach. I was so nervous. I'm still so tense, and it seemed like we own the freeways because I think cars are afraid to come up. It's intense. It is. I've never experienced anything like this.
I put some meth in her Kool-Aid.
Cars are afraid to come up because they're the Mongols. Oh, this is too good. Well, we got more from Lisa because, you know, we're having fun, but it's serious. What is Lisa Ling up to and what's CN up to? Lisa is spending some time with the Mongols and us spending some time with Lisa. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More on this fascinating report after this. This is Lee Habib, and we are talking about Lisa Ling's This Is Life and her piece not too long ago about the Mongols, the bike gang, that really calls its home Southern California, but is a worldwide biker gang now with over 1,000 patched members. And I'm just wondering, well, we'll learn later what it takes to earn a patch. Something tells me it's not that much different than, let's say, Donnie Brasco getting made. Mm. Probably just playing a good poker game. Mixing up a good tomato sauce. That's right, Billy Bob. Hey, you got it.
Add some mustard in there.
That's right. So, we just picked off with Lisa getting the thrill of an open ride on a Harley. By the way, what a great commercial this was for Harley Davidson. And I love Harleys. Just not the guys sitting on these particular Harleys. These particular guys, that is. So, and she, and there was an incident with the cops for no reason.
No, no.
Pulled over the Mongols, and people on the road don't want to be near them for absolutely no reason.
Taking over both lanes.
Just taking over both lanes and looking menacing and having the word Mongols on their back.
Well, which is why she's doing this show, so people will
understand.
Yeah.
We'll understand, because that's right. There's a lot of discrimination.
Try to pass them, see what happens on the freeway.
Yeah, that would work out well. So Ling and the Mongols arrive at their destination and check into their hotel. Let's see how CNN and Ling cover their arrival.
After 2 hours on the road, we reach our destination, Palm Springs, California. The Mongols have booked an entire hotel for the weekend, and we've been invited to join them. Hundreds of outlaw bikers flood onto the property, and I'm curious how the hotel staff is handling it.
What are they like as customers?
These folks have been perceived that they are violent, they are ruthless. Yes. That's not the case. That what we have experienced, they are so kind and absolutely the most well-behaved group that we ever get.
Are you trying to be a Mongol, Aftab?
Where do you excellent service?
Oh, they're just such sweet boys. So we're wondering, when is Lisa Ling going to mention the criminality? Let's continue.
There are many moments when I forget that this club is under indictment by the federal government.
Have you joined yourself?
So far, yeah.
Who are you riding with?
I rode with Santos.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
okay.
Did
yeah.
you? I like your shirt.
Thank you.
Sleep safe. You. Sleep with the Mongol.
Ugh. Well, it keeps going, folks. We've forgotten, by the way, and it still hasn't been mentioned, they're under federal indictment. That's a thought. Yeah, you can just skip that over. Maybe it's because Ling is running footage complimenting Mongols' wives for their tastes in T-shirt and family fun instead of covering more pressing issues. But now it's time for new members to be patched in. Well, let's listen to more Lisa Ling.
Everybody listen up. Hey, we're going to patch in our brother right here.
We're at the Mongols' national run, and this is the moment every prospect waits for. The moment he gets his final patch and becomes a Mongol.
Listen up. Back up. We have a lot of prospects that are getting patched in. Get the circle a little wider.
It's a serious and sacred ritual that no one from the media has ever been allowed to document. It's here that I see Mike, the prospect I met at his home a couple days ago. He's finally getting patched in.
He's a damn good prospect. I hate to patch him up because he's a damn good prospect.
So describe the feeling right now.
Just overwhelming. Excitement, joy. This is one big family. And the time you put in and was all for your brothers.
Oh, he got his first Girl Scout patch.
That's right. And big all for his brothers, like the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, brotherhood, sisterhood. What about the criminal thing? Well, as I said earlier, there is a moral red line that Ling will not allow anyone to cross without hard questioning and tough scrutiny. You've heard it so far, haven't you? I mean, this is journalism at its best. Lil Dave patches up Mike. What's he getting patched up for? Could it be their drug trafficking assaults? Maybe a good murder, a good robbery, a good meth lab being cracked open? Let's see what causes Ling to, as she says, have a lot of questions.
I have a lot of questions about the status of bikers' wives and girlfriends. Women wear patches declaring them property.
It's not a disrespect, trust me. For all you women out there, and I know some of you are feminists.
I'm being calm about it.
See, now Lisa doesn't care about what they do for a living. They don't care about how they get their patches. But my goodness, the women wear a t-shirt that says, I'm my boy's property. And my goodness, this just tips the moral scales for Lisa.
With okay. A little bass solo in there, too.
Yeah, that's right.
Everybody listen up.
Everybody listen up. Okay, some finally some moral outrage from Lisa. Wait, she's upset because of we just heard it. That word property. On the subject of patches, Ling finally asks the Mongols' president about them. Are they earned for killing somebody? Let's see if Ling can restrain her anger here.
I saw that there is a patch, skull and crossbones, for taking out a target. Is that true? I mean, here's the thing, because it's online, so you can, I mean, tell me as much
public
as
public record. I haven't seen it online. I mean, that's news to me.
I can pull it up right now.
You know, in a self-defense situation, maybe a brother was awarded that, but on the patch situation, I just want to keep full anonymity on that. Just
okay.
Yeah, anonymity. That's good, Lisa.
Okay,
that's her response.
That's good. Just thought I'm finished. I don't want to dig deep here.
I don't know nothing about that.
But Lisa is not finished. This intrepid journalist is not done yet. And here's Ling tracking down the Mongols' wives, isolating them in a bar, and interrogating them about the crime of subjugating themselves to their husbands.
These women are all working professionals, and yet none of them seem to mind being labeled as someone's property.
So what is it like to wear things that say property of?
I feel powerful in a sense.
I love it.
It's just another symbol of respect for ourselves and for our men.
But does it make you feel owned?
Owned? No.
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 I'm proud of my properties. It's like, how do you feel when you put your wedding ring on? Proud.
But when it comes to the club, are you supposed to be submissive?
Submissive. That word.
It's like it sets us back. Like in the 1950s.
And it's like a dog is submissive. I mean, we respect our husband and we respect the club.
And I think our role is a choice.
Yeah.
Well, Lisa's not getting far here. But again, this is where her outrage lies. She doesn't follow up on the patchwork and how you get a patch. But my goodness, this property thing's really getting under her skin. She tries again. At least the Mongols' wives are working professionals and not stay-at-home moms. So that's a plus for Lisa. That would have required even further scrutiny. But this episode has come to an end, and like all endings of CNN, This Is Life, Lisa Ling does her Jerry Springer-like final thought. She addresses the camera so that viewers don't miss the point of her show. And here's what's inside the mind after an hour of this rubbish of Lisa Ling.
Our time with the Mongols is coming to a close, and I feel like I'm just beginning to scratch the surface. I can only draw conclusions from what I've been allowed to see. This brotherhood is like a fraternity, a unique kind of family for its members.
It is a fraternity.
There's no doubt they have each other's backs no matter what. And as for the rest,
let's be clear, there are Mongols who have committed crimes. There may be Mongols who are still committing crimes. And they may engage in some secretive rituals that could be perceived by the public as being unsavory.
Allegedly.
But that doesn't mean that as an organization, they are criminals. The only thing I wouldn't do is with them, because then you're going to have problems.
What did she say?
I think that she said just what we thought she said. Yeah.
Okay.
That's some deep stuff. You know, I could just imagine her talking about riding in the open-air Toyotas somewhere in the Middle East with these really interesting group of guys that some say murder some people, but who's to say?
Now, does the burqa make you feel submissive?
Oh, no.
Oh, my goodness. What rubbish. Again, what's in the mind of Lisa Ling and CNN? So that's the moral of the story, folks. The Mongols are one big happy family, one big fraternity. They love to grill. They love to ride on the open road. Yeah, maybe one or two of their guys go off the track and murder somebody.
A couple of bad apples,
but that happens in every group. And why would you mess with Gandhi on a motorcycle? I mean, because that's what they're basically saying here. Lil Dave is a sweetheart. And what was with that statement she just made? There may be Mongols who are still committing crimes. I guess we also learn the Mongols might not be criminals.
Hmm.
Let's recap what we've ingested from the CNN episode of This Is Life with Lisa Ling. Mongols Motorcycle Club, no threat. Just misunderstood good guys, really. Patches on wives' jackets. Evil. That's the sequel, the yeah. women. And she's going to try and free them from the bondage of these men and maybe form their own outlaw biker gang. We can't make this up, folks. CNN makes it up. Lisa Ling, well, we can't wait for her next report and the new season.
Brilliant.
Because Greg Hengler is all over it. He is loving this. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. We bring you stuff and we watch the culture sometimes so you don't have to. Oftentimes, we just love watching the same things you do too, though, when we celebrate the culture. Go to ouramericannetwork.org to catch all of our material. We go out where we started with Steppenwolf, with Born to be Wild.
Loaded for space. I look smoking lightning. Heavy metal thunder. Racing with the wind.